You're listening to the Full and Thriving Podcast, a place where courageous women come to break free from food obsession, heal their relationship with their body, and strive to live a life that's present, lighthearted, and meaningful. If you're listening, my wish is that this podcast serves as a catalyst that inspires you to nourish your body, nurture your mind, and energize your spirit. I'm your host, Meg McCabe, a certified life coach and eating disorder recovery coach with a PhD in having a good time. Just kidding about that last part. Anyway, thank you so much for listening and enjoy the show. Today's guest is Dr. Sarah Chips. Dr. Chips is the founder and director of Well Williamsburg Psychotherapy and Sanctuary Intensive Outpatient Program for Complex PTSD. She is a licensed psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist supervisor. Dr. Chips specializes in the treatment of eating disorders, substance abuse, and trauma. Her own recovery from an eating disorder and substance dependence gives Sarah an inside perspective that helps her both support and challenge her clients. In this episode, Dr. Chips expands on the intersection of dissociation, identity disorder, and eating disorders. This is a complex topic, and Sarah does an amazing job breaking down the basics for all of us in this episode. However, this topic is so nuanced that I would like to remind all of you that not one case is the same. Please note that this episode comes with a bit of a trigger warning as we talk about trauma and briefly mention physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. This episode is packed with information, so get ready to learn along with me during this one. Hi, Sarah. How are you doing today?
Hello, Meg. So good to see you and hear you.
Thank you so much for being on the show. It's so great to have you. How are things going over there in California this morning?
Well, it's a little bit gloomy outside, but it's still in the 60s and like it's pretty wonderful all the time in Southern California, but you know, outside, and I'm snuggly here in my office, my cats, and you know, I have no complaints. I have a lot of gratitude for my life.
I love that. Oh, yes. Southern California is gorgeous. I'm always envious of anyone who lives there. I wish I could be there, but none of my family lives out there. So it's hard for me to make the call to go out to California, but it is gorgeous over there. I completely agree.
You're in Portugal right now. So
in Portugal right now, but I don't live here. I'm usually in Connecticut, which is like New York, Boston area.
Totally. I know Connecticut.
Oh, you know Connecticut? Most people don't. Their only reference is Gilmore Girls.
Okay. Well, you know, not a bad reference.
It is. That's our claim to fame. Gilmore Girls, our claim to fame. And it's very accurately depicted. I would say Stars Hollow is a lot like the towns that I grew up in. Like small, cute, towny. Did you ever watch the show?
You know what? I watched bits and pieces of it, and some of my clients are very connected to the show. And so I feel like I know it, even though I don't know it intimately. And I feel like just meeting you right now, it all makes sense. This all goes together and you make sense there. And I love it.
Oh, I love that. That makes me really happy. I'll take it. Okay. But let's dive into this episode of the show.
And that's about how cute and funny we are.
Let's just dive into the podcast episode today. So today we are talking all about dissociative identity disorders and the intersection with eating disorders. This is kind of a complex topic. And before we dive in, I really want to hear about you. Could you tell me about your journey to becoming a psychologist and how that ended up linking up with eating disorders and DIDs?
Sure. Okay. So I grew up in a family of counselors and therapists, and my grandfather was a psychologist. He was one of the first psychologists in San Diego where I grew up. And so I kind of grew up in the psychology culture, but I was not going to do that. I was going to be an English professor. And then I was like, maybe I don't want to do that. I can figure it out. I mean, when you're in your early 20s, I think it's just so typical. And people, a lot of my clients really stress about, what am I going to do? What am I going to be? I have to have a passion. And I was just kind of like, I'm just going to like put one foot in front of the other. And I've never really stressed about what I'm going to do next, which is, I realize it's just like a blessing that for some reason the universe gifted me with, like not worrying about the end game. And so I've just been able to like feel out what's right for me as I went along. So I ended up working in tech in San Francisco, and I was working in tech in San Francisco, and I developed eating disorder in college and kind of recovered from that, kind of in that, you know, I was eating enough and, you know, taking care of my body in eating ways, but I had developed a substance abuse disorder. And I was in the dot-com sphere, and there was a lot of kegs in the office and a lot of parties after work. And the whole industry was really set up for these new kids who were coming out of college and making a lot of money at Google and Yahoo. You remember Yahoo? And yes. That was such a dig. And all of these tech companies. And so they were really creating this culture by kind of pumping them full of fun, right? And my genetics set me up to, you know, not want the fun to end. And so I ended up getting sober and being like, I can't be here anymore. And so then I was like, I kind of ran away to grad school. And then I was like, oh, this is so right for me. This feels like the right thing. So that's how I became a psychologist, kind of accidentally. So then I really wasn't planning on treating eating disorders. And I ended up in college counseling centers. I was treating substance abuse a little bit in the beginning of my career. I worked at some rehabs for substance abuse, and that was good. And I was working in college counseling centers, and the people who were my supervisors were like, you seem to know a lot about eating disorders. And they just started sending people with eating disorders. And then they suggested, you should go and do your postdoc in an eating disorder setting. And it's like, okay, I guess I'll do that. And so I did that. And then I just kind of fell into eating disorder treatment, and that really worked for me and felt really good. And I was able to use my experience as somebody who had recovered from an eating disorder in that way. And then while I was treating eating disorders and working, I worked at Montanito for a long time, and I was a clinical director there. And when I left, I started private practice, and a number of people who I had worked with over the years at Montanito reached out and wanted me to be their therapist. And I love these people. So I said, yes. And they, a number of these people, they had eating disorders for a long time. And some of them, nobody wanted to see anymore. Like, they were so treatment resistant or difficult or aggressive, or, you know, they just didn't follow directions. They didn't seem to want it. It wasn't the right time for them, right? All of these things that people say about people with eating disorders when they can't fix them. And I started working with these people. And then one person was diagnosed by another therapist, an adjunct therapist. Actually, I was the adjunct therapist, but another therapist diagnosed them with dissociative identity disorder. And I was like, wait a minute. This person. And I figured out that I had 6 people on my caseload. Over the course of a couple of years, I figured out that I had 6 people on my caseload that had dissociative identity disorder. And then I thought, oh, shit. You can bleep that out. I thought, oh, shit. I don't know anything about this. I didn't get any training in grad school. I don't know how to treat this. And I have really great relationships, therapeutic relationships with these people. And so I got training. So I went and got training, and I got a supervisor, and I still work with a supervisor. And then I just kind of fell into that. So here I am treating people who had eating disorders. Some of them still do have eating disorders, who have dissociative identity disorder or other specified dissociative disorder, which is kind of like not quite DID.
Okay.
So I think of it as like the OSFED of the dissociative disorders world. And in that, you know, they maybe don't quite meet that criteria, but they have a very similar experience, and it's all on a spectrum, right? And just because they don't quite meet that criteria of DID, it doesn't mean that they're not really suffering.
Right.
Not like a lighter diagnosis. Everybody's experience is so different.
Right. Wow. I really appreciate you sharing your journey. I love that you were blessed with not being concerned about the end game so much and taking it one moment at a time, because going from tech to psychology, it's a big jump, right? But you have necessary reasoning, right, to make that leap. And it's fascinating to hear that you took that career turn and ended up where you are and ended up specializing in the specializations that you have. So I really appreciate that background. I know you're starting to dive into it. So I'd really love to define what dissociative identity disorder is. And it sounds like also that it's an umbrella term. And I'm kind of like, I don't know a ton about this. So please share the basics.
Okay, let's see. Let's go. Okay, dissociative identity disorder. When we are little, when we're born, let's go back to the beginning. The theory is, and I try to be really hold a lot of space for possibilities and different theories and different interpretations, because psychology today, and I'm going to curse again, but I say this all the time and I hold this to be true, is still a soft science shit show. There's so much we do not know. And there are some things that we kind of know, and, you know, maybe some things that we really know, like that punishment doesn't really work. But overall, we're still trying to figure out the human brain and the human experience. And so these are all theories, right? I just want to preface.
Okay.
So the current theory is that we are all born with parts that kind of show up as emotional or needs experiences in infancy, right? So there's a baby who's hungry. There's a baby who needs their diaper changed. There's a baby who's sleepy. There's a baby who's happy. And all of these experiences kind of are glued together with good parenting, with mirroring, and with, oh, are you hungry? Oh, you need your diaper changed. And so the child is held and contained, and kind of their identity is formed through the attachment with the caregiver. Right. Now, if there's a caregiver who is not able to be consistent and who perhaps is available at sometimes in a good way and sometimes in a very terrifying way, the child has to reconcile that, because it has no other place to go.
Mm-hmm.
You're stuck. You're an infant. There's literally nothing you can do. You can't even talk yet, right? And so disorganized attachment forms in this way, when the parent is both the attachment resource, the love, the caring, the food resource, and the perpetrator of terror. Mm. And terror can be physical abuse, sexual abuse. It can also be neglect. It can be emotional abuse. And it can look like many different things, right? And in fact, dissociative disorders later in life are better predicted by disorganized attachment than they are by severe childhood trauma.
Wow. Okay. That's actually very timely, because we just did an episode on attachment. So this is like the perfect link. I didn't even realize it was right there. So when that baby is little, it just seems like their foundations is filled with a lot of inconsistencies and a lot of terror, right? And the baby's trying to form, I guess everyone's different, but that baby's trying to make sense of it all and developing different identities in relation to their parent. Would you say that is correct?
Yeah. And I wouldn't even say identities, that like, I would say like ways of being.
Right? Yeah.
So, and terror can be just like loneliness. Like if you're left alone, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you're left hungry and you have no way of solving that, right? You cry and you cry and you cry and nobody comes. Mm-hmm. That feels like death, to a nightmare.
Yeah.
Right? That's terror. And so if that happens, you know, every once in a while, that all happens to us as kids, right? Like, no parents are perfect. We're all kind of, in a way, there's a resilience built in. But if that happens consistently, a time and time again, and the child has no solution outside of themselves, then the child has to find a solution inside of themselves in order to survive. Mm-hmm. And so that can feel like, oh, that's not happening to me. That's happening to another child.
Oh, okay.
I can be a different child. I can kind of slip into fantasy world, right? Mm-hmm. And so there might be this other component. And this is like a new idea that's coming into the theory. I mean, maybe it's not so new, but anyways, whatever theories. There's a new variable that I've really been considering that's maybe has good validity, is that there are some people who are born with a propensity for trance or for hypnotizability, if you will.
Oh, wow.
Just like some people have the gene for an eating disorder or for addiction, but we're not exactly sure what that gene is. And like, but you know, people talk about the environment turns that gene on, that light switch on.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that seems to also be a component.
I had no idea about that second component. So you're talking about two components. First of all, almost like disassociating from themselves and saying, this is happening to another child.
Or like, then, I'm not, or just maybe not, I mean, not always this is happening to another child, but like, I'm not here.
Okay. Okay.
Maybe just like, I'm not here. So sorry.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. And then also there's a part of them where they have this ability to bring themselves into a trance without consciously doing so. They can go into a hypnotic trance as part of an association. Wow, I didn't realize this. So I think one thing that intrigues me, so tell me if there is a difference. I hear people, especially on TikTok, talking about, oh, and then I dissociated. And I'm like, are they throwing that term around too quickly? Or is this a very common thing?
I do not know the specifics of every person on TikTok. So it's hard for me to say what, you know, but I will say that DID probably is about 1.5% of the population. Okay. People who meet the classic criteria for anorexia are about 0.4% of the population. People who meet the criteria for a bipolar disorder are about 0.16% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
People who have red hair are around 2% of the population. So we're looking at a number that is not super low. It's not uncommon, right? If you think about these other disorders, we don't think of bipolar disorder as like, that's extremely rare. You never see that, right? Mm. But I think that DID is something that has actually been underdiagnosed because people, I think, are afraid to diagnose it.
Okay, that makes sense. So to kind of bring it back to where we were talking, you mentioned there are those two factors that appear in childhood, sort mm-hmm. of. What's it like for that individual growing up, and how does that kind of all transform into DID? Like if we're growing this child up,
Uh-huh. Okay. Again, it's different for different people. And so I can't speak to everybody's experience, right? So I just want to preface with that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, the person might experience other parts of themselves as thoughts that aren't theirs, or emotions that don't quite feel like they belong to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they might experience them as, like I said, imaginary friends early in childhood. And some of the experiences that have been reported to me by people who are grown up and have awareness about this now is like my Greta, when we were doing this presentation, she shared that when she was 14, she knew that Santa Claus was not real, but she also really didn't know that Santa Claus was not real because a part of her really believed it still. A part of her was still young and kind of got stuck at a certain age where something happened or something didn't happen. And that's kind of where you see parts kind of get stop their development, right? So there will be a part that dealt with a certain situation and maybe that situation stopped. And so that's that part kind of stopped their development, but remained within the system serving the same function, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Somebody might have been suffering from severe sexual abuse as a child, and that stopped at a certain point, but there's still a part of them that believes that that is still happening and that they have to, for instance, keep somebody small so that they can hide, or so that they can maybe even become so small that they can reverse the aging process to a point before the trauma started happening, so that they're not big enough, because sometimes perpetrators will say, you're big enough for something now. And so they don't want to be big enough, or they associate growing up with more severe trauma happening. And so parts will kind of get stuck in this kind of function of trying to protect the person from something terrible happening to them in a way. But that as an adult, for instance, as when you're, you know, in your 30s and your 40s, then it just looks like an eating disorder.
Interesting. Okay. So basically what DID is, and I know I'm going to not say this perfectly, but would you say it's a culmination of parts of you, like that you have maybe resulting from trauma in childhood or other reasons that are like a collection of parts that stayed stuck in that stage of development? And now you're living with multiple versions of you as an adult in one form?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Glad I was able to verbalize that. So it seems like such a complex disorder. So what I'm hearing now is that the way this relates to eating disorders is that people might develop parts that are protecting themselves using the eating disorder.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. So that can look like restriction, right? It can look like purging, because you're trying to get something out of you that was put into your body that makes you feel gross or that's associated with severe trauma. It can look like drinking a lot of water to try to cleanse the body. Mm. And so, or using laxatives to try to cleanse the body. And so often eating disorder professionals who are trying to be eating disorder professionals are like, you got to stop using laxatives. You just have to stop that. Like, it's really harming your body. But inside, there's a part that's so terrified that if they don't do that, that they won't be able to get this badness out of them, right? Or to stop the trauma from happening. And so it's really that part is trying to help, but in a way that's no longer effective, maybe was never effective, but was the only like fantasy of control that that child had.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I really appreciate that example because it helps kind of solidify how an eating disorder might manifest if you have DID. You mentioned restriction. I assume that's about getting smaller. Like, you're not getting smaller for like appearance reasons, it's actually smaller out of protection. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, well, we know this, that like people with eating disorders often get pegged as very vain or very egotistical or narcissistic. We're trying to, you know, make ourselves look a certain way to look like Barbie or something, but it's so more complicated than that. So the restriction can be, I've seen this as something that the person has fantasized will get them to a younger point before the trauma got bad. I've also seen this, which I guess perhaps is very related, but I've also seen this as a way to prevent being seen as sexual.
Yeah, I've seen that as well.
Mm-hmm. So, just a way to not look curvy and not be seen as a sexual object in general, right? When you have a complex dissociative disorder, we can see this in brain imaging scans. part of your brain is supposed to like signal to your amygdala, hey, there's danger here. And in classic PTSD, this part of your brain is signaling to your amygdala, hey, all the time there's danger. And so for classic PTSD people, like hyper alert all the time, right? For people with dissociative disorders, that part of your brain actually signals to your amygdala, just turn off.
Mm.
And so that's part of the dissociative trance, is just turning off that sense of danger. And so that doesn't always kick in for people who have complex dissociative disorders, and that can be dangerous actually. And so the very thing that you're attempting to do by restricting, because I think of eating disorder behaviors and substance abuse behaviors for people with complex dissociative disorders are dissociative boosters. Mm-hmm. They're going to make you more dissociative. And that is a learned coping strategy early in childhood, right? If something really bad's happening and you can say, I'm not here, and that's your only way out, then that's what you're going to go to. And then later in life, that is just a learned coping strategy and people keep going back to it. But it's actually, once you're an adult and you have agency and you have the ability to drive away or not be around certain people, which you don't have an ability to do when you're little, it becomes a liability to be dissociative, right? And so part of treatment is helping people have more control over their dissociation, not to take it away, because we can't do that, right? And we wouldn't want to do that. Dissociation has served this really important function for people. But I want my clients to have more control over what they use it and when they don't use it, and awareness about when they're using it.
Okay. So it's another form of a coping skill, but it turns into a liability, just like many other coping skills actually do turn into liabilities. Is the eating disorder, that is a form of disassociation then?
Yeah, I think of it as a booster. It makes the dissociation more intense, right? Because for instance, you're not well fed, your brain, it needs to use all that energy just to do like basic, like beating of your heart, et cetera. And so it doesn't have that energy to give to you to be present. Anybody with an eating disorder has had that experience of just like that numbing state, whether it's from like throbbing up or from restricting or other things. And you can, and I do see people who are very motivated, go out and buy books. Like there's one called Coping with Trauma-Related Dissociation by Boone, Steele, and Vanderhart. And there's another book called Finding Solid Ground by Bethany Brand. And these are books that can give you some like very basic stabilization skills. Mm-hmm. And you can work with a therapist on them as well. Mm-hmm. And they're not about trauma processing. They're about learning how to ground in the present moment, bring your mind back to here and now, to now time, and realize when your mind has kind of slipped into memory time, which is usually filled with a lot of emotion and trauma memories, or to know when you're just kind of zoning out, you're dissociating, right?
Okay.
So, I mean, people with DID have more than one apparently normal part of self, more than one part of self that interacts with the world, does daily function tasks. And then they can have a host of emotional parts. And these parts are sometimes younger, sometimes the same age, but hold the emotions that feel like too much or not allowed for the apparently normal part. And so people with OSDD might have only one apparently part of self and a lot of emotional parts of self, or they might not have amnesia, or they might not have quite as many divisions in their sense of self. And so it's a little bit subjective, and it's a soft science shit show. The DSM does not do a great job of describing these disorders. I mean, they're okay, but I think it can be confusing if you're trying to put yourself on the spectrum just reading the DSM.
So how would you approach helping someone who has that intersection of DID and an eating disorder? Like, what are some suggestions? I mean, for people listening who might feel like they're dealing with this.
Yeah. So the first thing is we got to stabilize you physiologically first. Mm-hmm. So we've got to work on you eating, not throwing up, just taking care of your body in general, sleep, et cetera, right? Because if you're not physiologically set up, then it's going to get wacky. It's going to be much harder. The second thing, and like drugs, alcohol, of course, right? Like we got to kind of like take those things off the table for a while at least. And the second thing is start working on being in the here and now. So working on grounding techniques, working on coping strategies that are retraining your brain to have control over whether or not you kind of slip into a dissociative trance-like state or into memory time and emotional part. So building that awareness. And that's really hard because there's a reason why parts of self developed, and it was to dissociate from memories, thoughts, ways of being that felt not allowed or terrible to the person. And so there is almost always, I would say always, but I can never be so black and white about it. But I would say always a phobic avoidance of some internal experience, because there's a reason why these things have been separated. There's a reason why I am not that other part, right? Mm-hmm. And so starting to build some capacity around accepting those other ways of being you and those other emotions and starting to have some compassion for those other parts. Mm-hmm. And also realizing that when you're feeling big emotions, it's a part trying to get help from you, or it's a part trying to get help in general. And if you have an adult part of self that is regulated, that has the capacity to help, even if you can imagine another child, like a child in the external world, could you bring that same kind of compassion and that same kind of tolerance that you could bring to an external child to your internal children? That's kind of like longer term work, right? And, you know, I've gotten the feedback that I shouldn't say that it takes a long time to recover from a dissociative disorder, but I can't lie about that. It does take time and it takes years. And so just know that, but have patience. It does get better. I do see people getting better from these disorders and from these experiences. And so there's hope, and there's a lot of people out there who are talking about, oh, they have dealt with really difficult things that you can look up on the internet. There's a podcast called the System Speak podcast, which is really great, done by a therapist who has DID. There's resources out there. So be brave and keep showing up.
Wow. Well, Sarah, this has been so informative and helpful. Thank you for sticking with me where I'm asking all these clarifying questions to help me and the listeners understand exactly what this looks like and how it relates to eating disorders. Like I said, it's such a complex topic, and I'm sure we just scraped the surface, but I really appreciate everything you've shared today, especially what healing can look like at the very end. So thank you so much, Sarah, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Meg. It's been just a pleasure to talk with you today. And I know we covered a lot of ground, and I tried my best to make a very complex topic digestible, and I hope that came across.
Yes, you did fabulously. And for those who might want to like work with you or learn more from you, how can they get in touch?
Sure. So I have an intensive outpatient program called Sanctuary. that's based in New York, and we treat complex PTSD and dissociative disorders. And that website is www.sanctuaryheals.com.
Thank you so much. All right, Sarah, I hope you have a beautiful day.
Thank you. You too. Thank you, Meg.
You're welcome.
All right, that concludes this week's episode of the Full and Thriving Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode of the show. When you have a moment, please head on over to Instagram and follow my recovery coaching account at Meg_McCabe to stay up to date on everything I'm doing in recovery land. And if you're feeling extra inspired, please send me a direct message to let me know how this podcast has impacted your life. I'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.